Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, January 21st. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, standing up to Russia.
We continue to look for a range, at a range of different ways to support Ukraine.
Canada loans $120 million to Ukraine as Russian troops amass at the border. But what happens to the Canadian troops over there training Ukrainian forces? Will they stay if conflict breaks out? MPs debate in moments. And the Omicron peak. Canada's top doctor says Omicron may have peaked, but hospitalizations are still on the rise as provinces are readying reopenings yet again. But are they moving too fast or too slow? Doctors dig into that. Plus, pocketbook pressures. Canadians are paying more for almost everything. Is there a political price to pay? We'll bring in the Friday strategy session. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. We begin with the simmering tension at the Ukraine-Russia border. Russia has been very clear it wants Ukraine under its control or sphere of influence and is flexing its muscles with 100,000 troops on the border and major military action by air and sea in the region. Today, top diplomats from the United States and Russia met in Switzerland amidst concern that Vladimir Putin is on the verge of invading. The U.S. warning Russia must back down or face a huge response by the West.
It seeks to, hide Kyiv's attempts to sabotage the Minsk agreements. I see no other option.
So that's the choice that Russia faces now. It can choose the path of diplomacy that can lead to peace and security, or the path that will lead only to conflict, severe consequences, and international condemnation.
But it is still unclear what, if anything, may have been achieved in the high-level diplomatic talks. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken saying he'll respond to Russia's proposals and is calling for more talks next week. Meanwhile, here in Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced a $120 million loan for Ukraine.
We continue to look for a range, at a range of different ways to support Ukraine. The announcement of $120 million in a loan to the Ukrainian government is one of the top things that they asked for. But we are, of course, looking to do more, and we will have more to say as the situation unfolds.
And Ukraine has asked Canada to send military supplies to its army like the UK has done. But today, the Prime Minister would not confirm reports that the government has sent any defensive equipment. So, is $120 million enough? Or is it time for a conversation about sending weapons to Ukraine? To date, Canada's main threat has been sanctions. But just yesterday, Russia's ambassador to Canada told Power Play that Russia isn't bothered by Western sanctions. So, how should Canada respond? And as tensions rise, what should Canada do with the 200 troops currently in Ukraine on a training mission? Let's ask the MPs. Rob Oliphant is the Foreign Affairs Parliamentary Secretary. James Bizan is the Conservatives' Deputy Opposition Whip. And Heather McPherson is the NDP's Foreign Affairs Critic. Thank you all for being there, for taking the time to talk to us. And, you know, welcome to Power Play. Mr. Bizan, I'd like to start with you. So Canada will loan Ukraine up to $120 million. And the Prime Minister says the government is exploring other ways to get involved and to help. What's your reaction to this? And what specific action is your party looking for?
You know, Ukraine has already proven themselves in the past under the former conservative government when Russia first invaded Crimea and Donbass. We provided two loans of $200 million apiece. Ukraine repaid that $400 million a couple of years ago. So $120 million is well received by Ukraine, but still there's no announcements on providing lethal defensive weapons, which we know that Britain, the United States, Poland, the Czech Republic, as well as Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia have all provided the ability for Ukraine to defend itself against a tank and ground invasion across their borders. There's no mention at all of bringing in Minsky sanctions, what the liberals have sat on for the past 3 years and allowed to collect dust. So we need to name and shame those Russian and other individuals who are responsible for this escalation along Ukraine's border. And finally, you know, we need to make sure that RadarSat imagery is being restored so Ukraine can watch what's happening on their borders and how Russia is amassing its troops and artillery. Of course, one of the very first foreign affairs actions by this Trudeau government was to cancel those RadarSat images that the former Conservative government had been supplying to Ukraine. So we need to be there standing shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine. We have to announce at the very least that we're going to extend Operation Unifier. We should be expanding it to provide even more training opportunities and to work alongside Russian or Ukrainian forces to push back on the potential Russian invasion that's coming because of Putin's desire to completely destabilize NATO, more first and foremost, and secondly, to ensure that Ukraine never shows its true democratic will of actually aspiring to join into the EU and NATO itself. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Mr. Oliphant, so the Russians have said, you know, sort of any help would be perceived, as an aggression. What's your reaction to what, you know, Mr. Bazan just said?
I don't think we have a lot of differences, actually. I think this is actually increasingly becoming a nonpartisan issue. The reality is the loan that was provided today under the sovereign loans a regime is something that Ukraine asked for and that we are very pleased to provide. I think Canadians are very pleased to provide. And it does build on previous loans that were effectively repaid by Ukraine by 2020, right on schedule. What I would say is that Canada and Canadians have been extremely engaged way before and into a much greater degree than many of our allies with the training forces we've had under Operation Unifier. And it's 200 people at a time, and so several hundred Canadian Armed Forces officers have gone through that system. 33,000 Ukrainian troops have been trained by Canadians. That is tremendously effective. That is the best way to help Ukraine in that defensive operation. And there is no intention to change what we're doing, only to continue to augment what we're doing. However, doing it cautiously and carefully, because we know that we want a diplomatic solution. Nobody wants a war. Everything that we are doing, that Minister Joly has been doing on this very extensive trip in Europe this week, has been to foster peace, dialogue, discussion, and find a diplomatic solution to this problem. That's what we're going to do. That's what we're committed to doing.
And that's what the U.S. Secretary of State said as well. Everybody is hoping for a diplomatic solution. Yesterday on CTV's Power Play, Russia's ambassador to Canada, Oleg Stepanov, shared how Russia would respond to potential Canadian sanctions. Take a look at this.
In our view, it's general, philosophically, sanctions never work. And sanctions never will be able to work against such countries, such nation as Russia. The attempts to use sanctions as threat in order to make Russia to do certain steps on international arena is just an illusion.
Just an illusion. Ms. McPherson, your reaction to this, because on Power Play this week you said you didn't think now is the time to give arms to Ukraine, and, you know, said Canada's not yet explored every diplomatic tools. Are sanctions diplomatic tools?
Absolutely they are. And, I mean, I listened to the ambassador speak, and with all due respect, I mean, let's check the source here. You know, my 13-year-old son often tells me when he does not want me to punish him either. We know sanctions work, and there is a number of different sanctions we can use. There is the Magnitsky sanctions, the individual sanctions. There is sanctions, you know, I've been talking to folks from the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress who've been asking for removing Russia from the SWIFT international payments. You know, there's oil and gas sanctions we can use. There are a number of different tools we can use. The goal here, and I think we all can agree, but the goal must be to de-escalate the situation, to provide deterrence to Russia, to work towards a peaceful solution that that does not result in civilian deaths, that does not result in increased militarization. And I think sanctions are one of those tools. You know, I'm also pleased to see the government bring forward this $120 million loan. I think making sure that Ukraine has that economic stability is an important step. So sanctions are on the table, and I think that, you know, it's been proven time and again that those sanctions do work.
You know, James Bazin, what do you make of the, you know, ambassador's comments on sanctions? I mean, sanctions will only work if they're internationally sort of organized, not only Canadian sanctions, but those allies that the Americans we're talking to this week don't seem to even agree on, you know, imposing sanctions. So what did you make of the ambassador's comments?
The ambassador is just repeating, you know, the audacious talking points coming from the Kremlin, and he has to be a good boy and has their mantra that he has to repeat. So, you know, the reality is the sanctions do work. The Russian national GDP is smaller than that of Canada. Sectoral sanctions, individual sanctions will hurt. And we know that the last time major sanctions were applied against Russia after they illegally occupied and annexed Crimea, that their GDP took a significant hit. The only reason that they can talk boldly right now is because gas and oil prices are going up. So we need to look at, you know, sectoral sanctions. But, you know, we have the Minsky sanctions. We know that the United States, Britain, and other allies are going to be using them. Canada should be moving in lockstep with them, targeting those individuals, making sure they aren't using our free market systems, our sound banking institutions, our vigorous and healthy real estate market to hide their wealth. We cannot be a safe haven for them to hide their families and have them using our universities. And so the naming, shaming, and making sure that they aren't taking advantage of Canada in particular, but our allies as well, is something that we need to do. And unfortunately, the Liberals have allowed Magnitsky sanctions to sit on the shelf for 3 years. Okay. They have failed to announce anything in this last tour of Minister Joly. They went to Ukraine originally empty-handed. Now, after the fact, we're hearing about possible announcements, and $120 million is a first good step. But we do need a lot more, and Ukraine needs us to stand there shoulder to shoulder with them so they can stop Russia now.
I do need to comment on sanctions.
But I want to ask you, Mr. Oliphant, if it's time to have this debate in Parliament.
I think, as some of our colleagues will know, that a number of Liberal MPs have called for a take-note debate, or, failing that, an emergency debate as soon as Parliament resumes. It is an important place for that discussion to be held. I do want to say, get this on record, that 440 Russian individuals and entities have been sanctioned since the illegal invasion and occupation of Crimea. 440, and that's under both the Magnitsky Act as well as the Special Economic Measures Act. We have targeted, disciplined, sanctioned regime in Canada. We're doing it with our allies. It doesn't mean we're finished yet. Right now, on the table, is more being developed. Absolutely. Sanctions do work. And I think Heather was absolutely spot on.
I just very quickly, because I have no more time left, but I want to hear Heather McPherson very quickly. A debate in the House of Commons, would that be a way to bring in more Canadians into the debate?
I think that's a great idea. I mean, we've talked about it at the Foreign Affairs Committee as well. We'd like to be able to have a study undertaken there. I think there is a lot of opportunities for us to do this. So I would definitely support a debate within the House of Commons, almost immediately upon our return next week.
Oh, thank you for the three of you, Mr. Oliphant, Mr. Bazin, Ms. McPherson. Thanks for joining us. I'm sure we'll be talking about this for weeks to come, and hopefully there will be a diplomatic solution. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
I'll hope so. Thanks so much.
Coming up, tracking the peak.
In the week since the modelling update, there are early indications that infections may have peaked at the national level.
If Omicron is peaking, how long before it's safe to drop restrictions, or at least some of them? Top doctors join the show next. Stay right here with PowerPlay. welcome back. Has Canada finally turned a corner on Omicron? Our top doctor, Theresa Tam, says Omicron infections may have peaked nationally, according to early indicators. But she warns that hospitalizations and ICU admissions continue to rise dramatically. Listen to this.
There are early indications that infections may have peaked at the national level, including daily case counts, test positivity, RT, or the effective reproduction number, and wastewater surveillance trends. However, daily hospital and ICU numbers are still rising steeply, and many hospitals across Canada are under intense strain.
But how does a peak in Omicron infections translate to the situation on the ground? Does that give provinces the green light to start easing public restrictions, like we saw Ontario Premier Doug Ford announcing yesterday? Or should provinces hunker down until hospitalizations get under control? Let's bring in a panel of medical experts and break it all down. Dr. Peter Uni, the scientific director for the Ontario COVID-19 Science Advisory Table, is here. And Dr. Lisa Barrett, an infectious disease specialist, joins us from Halifax. Doctors, welcome to Power Play. Thank you for being there, and thank you for the work you do. Dr. Uni, when you hear Canada's chief public health officer saying Omicron may have peaked across Canada, does that give you a sigh of relief, or do your own modeling numbers alarm you?
I'm looking at our own data, and as a matter of fact, tonight we will start to post on our dashboard wastewater data province-wide from Ontario, and you will see that these data indicate that we have peaked during the first part of January, which is great news, and this is now accompanied by a high plateau of hospital occupancy in Ontario, and now also likely a peak in ICU occupancy. So it's great news right now, but we need to be aware of one thing. This was us influencing this wave. We flattened it, we prolong it, and this means we need to be very careful. This is not the natural behavior of the wave, what we're seeing here in Ontario. Therefore, it's important to keep doing what we're doing, open slowly, and really, really rush with third doses. We need third doses in people's arms to keep this under control now.
So, Dr. Barrett, does saying Omicron may have peaked in Canada run the risk of giving Canadians a false sense of security? Or does it give hope that there's a light at the end of the tunnel? In other words, do you sense that we're all so anxious to be a little freer that we're getting ahead of ourselves?
Well, I sense many things, but I'll stick to the science part of it. I would echo what Dr. Uni just said. This is not just the virus behavior. This is a person-made, policy-made situation in Ontario and in some other provinces. And I do think that people are at a point where they are quite fatigued and they want to hear end, the word end, start to come into many things. We're about to change a whole lot of behavior, not just in Ontario, but also in other provinces, sending people back into school only a week ago. We need to see what's going to happen when those changes occur before we can decide to go forward. And to be honest, it really is imperative. I've said this a few times, it's not just rough in hospitals right now. It's nigh on people not getting at the same quality of care they'd get 6 months ago, and that's not acceptable. So we really do have to be cautious and follow the numbers and not just say, we peaked and stopped looking. We got to keep looking.
So when they say, Dr. Barrett, that we're on the other side of the peak, what does it mean? It means we've plateaued, now we're going to go down, we're expecting cases to go down?
We hope so, again, but that is somewhat dependent, we think, on some of the precautions and or restrictions that we've been using. Certainly, it's not exactly been an open situation in Ontario, nor in other provinces like Nova Scotia. And so when we're on the other side, that's a retrospective look. That's a look backward. Nothing says that we won't see another little upswing as we start to pull things back. And if we do, honestly, until we finish getting boosters out, under 12s vaccinated, some natural exposure immunity plus the oral antivirals in place as a combination packet, we're going to have to be very careful about looking backward as opposed to forward. And what I mean is that just because the cases went down doesn't mean they will stay that way unless we're careful.
Okay, so to that point, Dr. Yoon, yesterday the Ontario government announced plans to gradually reopen the province starting at the end of this month. Is it premature for the Ford government to announce this plan when they estimate the peak in hospitalizations to be in mid-February?
It won't be in mid-February. We have peaked in terms of hospitalizations, but we need to be careful that after this peak, you know, on this high plateau, we don't go up more when we open up more. So luckily, you know, during the last 3 to 4 days, we have seen that our numbers in hospital really have stabilized. That's true. That's real now. The point now is, you know, when we start to open more, and as Dr. Barrett already said, you know, we already have opened up schools, then we need to be very careful that we don't accelerate again and have more growth that will result in even more strain in our hospitals. But the positive news is we know exactly what to do. Take it slow. So don't just rush, you know, wherever you can when something is opening, and really push for third doses and have your kids vaccinated. This will help tremendously, together with the infections that also will offer immunity, of course.
So basically what the doctors are telling us here is baby steps, take it a little slower. Dr. Peter Yoon and Dr. Lisa Barrett, thank you first for your frontline service and for being there for us and answering our questions. Have yourselves a wonderful weekend.
You too.
And coming up, Canadians are paying more for almost everything. What will voters expect from the government? Our Friday strategy session weighs in next. Stay with us. We will be right back. And welcome back. Anyone who's been to the grocery store or gas station lately knows that prices have been on a dramatic rise this year. And this week, Statistics Canada confirmed inflation hit a 30-year high at 4.8% in December. Today, a new poll from the Angus Reid Institute is shedding a light on how many Canadians are struggling to make ends meet. The poll shows that 57% of Canadians are currently finding it difficult, as opposed to easy, to feed their families. That number is up from 36% in 2019. The poll also found that 39% of Canadians believe their financial standing has worsened in the past year. That marks the highest number of Canadians who report feeling this way since Angus Reid started tracking this back in 2010. Will high food prices and a growing financial strain force the government to take drastic action? Should the feds bring back their minister for middle-class prosperity? Or has the pandemic made Canada's middle class disappear? Let's take that to our panel of strategists. Greg McCachran from Proof Strategies leans liberal. Adrian Batra, the Toronto Sun's editor-in-chief, brings the conservative voice. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director. And Greg Weston from Earnscliffe Strategy Group has a nonpartisan perspective. Nice to see you. Happy Friday, strategists. We've got a lot to go through, so let me start with you, Greg McCachran. When you see a poll that shows that almost 60% of Canadians are worrying about high food prices, how should the government jump into action, and can it even?
Well, it's tough. As all the experts will say, this is a worldwide phenomena. It's not just Canada. But the government can't ignore that. They, you know, what we used to say about Bill Clinton, you know, that he would feel your pain. The government has to show that they're doing that. And they can't just talk about childcare seats that are they're coming. There's a reality right now. And again, there's not a lot that any one country can do about this. This is, you know, supply chain. This is, you know, the pandemic. And you know, within the supply chain, there's some issues as well. But the government has to appear that they are aware of this. You said a minister of middle class prosperity, bringing that back. I was thinking back in the days when we had a minister of consumer and corporate affairs, a title that's long gone. But I do think that the government has to think about consumers. They have to think about people right now. Yeah. I also think the opposition has to be careful because they can't seem gleeful that this is happening. And they also have to make sure that they're not going to be called out for using misinformation to make their point. So there's some third rails here for all sides.
So, Adrian, I think he's talking about you. Apart from the pandemic, affordability was a huge issue during the election campaign this past summer. So, you know, is the government's plan to build more affordable housing and give $10 a day, you know, childcare enough? Because that's the answer, and that seems to be sort of the answer that comes back again and again. Is that enough? Are people buying it?
You know, you guys better save this tape because there's very little that Greg said that I disagree with. I think that the current government needs to be shown showing that they are understanding of it. And I think that's where a big part of the disconnect is no one for a moment believes that either Prime Minister Trudeau or any of his cabinet ministers really understand or appreciate what Canadians are dealing with on a daily basis. And so that's part of the challenge for the government. Then we have this all coupled with this other whole situation with the trucking industry and are we getting our goods across? So there are a lot of sort of red tape issues that the government could manage. The challenge that conservatives have is, you know, we don't want more government intervention in our lives. So we don't want to see, you know, them starting to control things or pricing and all of that sort of stuff. That's where the conservatives need to, you know, as Greg rightly says, be careful. And by that token, though, honestly, I don't believe that the opposition party has shown any sense of gleefulness. In fact, you know, they're hearing from Canadians, their constituents that are trying to manage through this on a regular basis and trying to, exude what they are saying to their elected officials. I don't think there's a magic bullet solution here. It is a global problem, but there are things that Canada can do to ease some of that burden.
Yeah. So Anne, the Parliamentary Budget Officer released a report Wednesday calling into question the government's justification for, you know, the planned stimulus spending with $100 billion. According to the PBO, the government has met its own requirements to wind down spending. So could or should the feds use this stimulus money to help Canadians struggling with high food prices? Do you see the government having to spend more or to rein it in?
Well, I mean, I think that there are some definite gaps in the pandemic supports. We've seen it with the clawback of GIS for vulnerable seniors, which was totally unfair and something needs to be done about that. So, I mean, you know, this the numbers that we saw today around Canadians who are worried about the rise in food prices, I think, is something that the government needs to really worry about, because that is something that really touches people every day, and it is noticeable. Anybody who's gone to the grocery store has seen that. But we also know that there are things that, you know, it's true what the other panelists have said about, you know, global supply chain and transportation issues that have created some of that, and the fact that it is not just a Canadian phenomenon. But there are things that are uniquely Canadian that I think drive inflation, and one of those is housing prices. And it's been, you know, it's a top of mind issue for Canadians. People are worried about finding affordable housing, being able to, afford their rent and their mortgages and those kinds of things. And there are things that the federal government can do in Canada that will help with that, and that will help reduce the kind of upward pressure of inflation.
But the PBO, Greg Weston, has said the government should you know, sort of claw back or slow down its stimulus spending. And we know that the Bank of Canada, you know, will start increasing the key interest rate. How do you see this playing out politically for the Liberals?
I think in the short term, it's certainly not serving them very well. The latest party polling numbers, Joyce, are showing both the Liberals and the Conservatives coming down, the NDP coming up. That shouldn't be a big shock. The group of Canadians in all of the Angus Reid survey that we've been talking about are on the lower end of the income spectrum. And obviously, they're the ones, 98% of those who said they're struggling are also the ones who are having trouble, say they're having trouble feeding their families. So that is a natural base for the NDP, and clearly we're getting that. I think we're also seeing a general kind of malaise setting in of Canadians saying we've had enough of the pandemic, and pretty soon they're going to start taking it out on Canadians if they haven't already started. And I think we're seeing both of that. The fact that we have high food prices right now, there's not that much government can do about it. It doesn't matter. It's still putting Canadians in a foul mood.
Could this, Greg McCachran, you know, people want to blame, are going to eventually want to blame someone or something. Does this play, you know, and will the Liberals get blamed? And would this play into, you know, the Conservative MP Pierre Poilievre's just inflation attacks? Will they work?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, for Mr. Poilievre and Mr. O'Toole is that they've been caught out by saying things that aren't exactly 100% true lately. I think the Liberals are probably happy that they're not facing a spring election at this point. So it may be a blessing that they went last fall, and even with the result that they got. I mean, times are really tough, Joyce. I heard of an MP this week that was looking for a free $2,000 chair. So things are, you know, might be really, really rough. I think what, you know, to your question, though, the government has to, at all times, you have to avoid stupidity. But right now, now would not be the time for someone to reveal that they're doing massive spending on a, you know, on a residence, or that they went on an expensive vacation. It's January in Canada. I can't get out my front door in terms of my car. It's cold. The Christmas bills are coming in. You know, people are miserable as it is. And the government has to be wise to listen and be aware of that.
Adrian, how do you see this playing politically? The House is coming back in a couple of weeks at the end of the month. How do you see this playing? And by then, the Bank of Canada will have increased or started increase. We're expecting several increases, perhaps by the end of the year, a 2% increase by the Bank of Canada. How do you see this playing out politically?
I actually see more frustration coming out in upcoming provincial or municipal elections than I would in no federal election anytime soon. So I think that lower levels of government political leaders are probably more acutely attuned to it than certainly maybe the federal government is, because the Liberals aren't going to be facing an election in the coming months or even in potentially a couple of years yet. So I think the polling numbers that we've seen are pretty much going to stay that way. You know, oppositions tend to come up a little bit when they are out of an election period. But it doesn't discount the fact that Justin Trudeau is still in charge of this country, and that he has a responsibility and a duty to all Canadians to do whatever they possibly can to ease this burden and at the same time deal with and manage the massive amount of spending that has been coming out of the federal coffers. So it's an unenviable position to be in, but, you know, governing is hard. And these are the times when we expect our federal government to step up.
Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. But you know what? I guess we're going to be talking about this issue for weeks to come, for months to come. Greg McCachran, Adrian Batra, Anne McGrath, Greg Wesson, thanks for being there. Have yourselves a lucky weekend. And if you can, try to stay warm.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
And coming up, releasing the records.
Families need this information. They want to know with certainty the relevant records have been released, and they have a right to that information.
The federal government is finally ready to release residential school documents. When will the public get access to the long-awaited files? We find out next. Stay right here with PowerPlay.
Survivors, families, and Indigenous communities have been clear from the start. Truth must come before reconciliation. It's taken too long to fully grasp the painful truth about residential schools and the racist and colonial policies that have denied Indigenous people their rights, their realities, their families, and their cultures.
And welcome back. And that was Crown Indigenous Relations Minister Mark Miller yesterday announcing an agreement to hand hundreds of thousands of residential school documents over to the National Centre for Truth and Reconciliation. Minister Miller announced this would happen last year. So what is the federal government sharing and how quickly will survivors and their families be able to mine the files for answers on their loved ones? Let's find out. Joining me now is the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation's Head of Archives, Raymond Frogner. Welcome to Power Play. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. How soon can these families finally get some answers in their hands on these documents?
First of all, thank you for having me. And I would like to say that the file transfers actually began today. So we have begun to receive documents. Given the scope or scale of the record volume that we're getting, it's going to take several days. So the file transfers will be going into next week, but they started today. Some of the more important ones that you might be aware of is the narratives from the independent assessment process for Cooper Island Residential School, the Kamloops Residential School. Those will be immediately reviewed and then encoded and placed on our website for full review by survivors.
So everybody will be able to access these documents. How do you go about and I mean, these are what, 700,000, 800,000 pages of documents, I'm told. It's a lot of stuff. So how do you sift through it? How do you tell a story? And how do you get to that truth that the minister was talking about just now?
I think the important thing to remember is that there is no kind of Da Vinci Code sort of lost file that will reveal the history that we've been looking for. What this does is it gives us more of a better understanding of the institutional operations of these schools. This was a systemic racism and program of genocide, and you find it expressed in the malnutrition, the poor health care, the improper shelter, the poor school curriculum. In all of these different sort of systemic ways, you'll find evidence of the program. And so getting these records gives us a better understanding of the residential school experience and how this system of this racial system of genocide operated.
Will you be able to identify some of these children? Will these documents speak to that?
I mean, there's always the opportunity to triangulate evidence that's in the records. And there will be opportunities for us to identify children that are in the records under the guidance and the supervision of the communities where they came from. We already have an online register that identifies the children that were lost at various residential schools across the country. That site was set up after over 6 months of consultation with communities across the country to understand just what kind of information should be and can be sensitively released regarding those children. So there will be a need, an ability to identify some in a very careful and respectful manner.
So very quickly, Raymond Frogner, how soon would these documents or some of these documents start going on the website?
It would be next week. The narratives that we received today will, as I said, be reviewed, encoded, and then uploaded onto the site for review as of next week. There is a lot of supporting documentation in these narratives, thousands of pages, and it's in that supporting documentation that we find some of the more egregious evidence of trauma and human rights violations. And in those cases, those documents will be reviewed for proactive release.
Amazing. Finally. Raymond Frogner, thanks for joining us and thanks for these details.
Well, thank you for having me.
And coming up, who snagged a political victory this week and who stumbled? The Press Gallery joins us next with their political plays and misplays of the week. Don't go away. And welcome back. Another week in politics wraps up, but some of the biggest stories are just getting started. So who ended this week on top and who fumbled in the political arena? Let's ask the Press Gallery. We have CTVnews.ca online politics producer Rachel Aiello. She also writes the Capital Dispatch newsletter, a must read, of course, and Toronto Star National columnist Susan Delacourt. Nice to see you both. She's also a must read. Nice to see you both. Happy Friday. Susan, I'm going to start with you because you seem to have a play and a misplay
at the same time.
The U.S. president. Yeah, at the same time. But, you know, he had a hard week, so you wanted to give him a break. But so tell us about it.
Yeah, you know, Nick Nanos was on your show on CTV this week talking about how there's a real challenge in communication at this stage in the pandemic. And I thought this was a bold and important risk by Joe Biden to spend 2 hours on the anniversary of his inauguration talking to reporters. And he was just taking the hits. He was being his Joe Biden friendly self. I enjoyed every minute of it. But so I would have given that play of the week, but it was a misplay too, because he flubbed badly an answer on the tension in the Russia and the Ukraine without going into too many details. He said that there would be degrees of response, and his officials had to spend the whole time after the press conference undoing that damage. And I thought it's a real shame, because I really like when politicians are authentic. I think we need more of that in the pandemic. I think Joe Biden needed a shot in the arm, and I think it's just going to make him even more careful and scripted now.
Rachel, I want to hear what you have to say about it, because, you know, it's true. He really did answer questions. He was out there, and, you know, he was being as genuine as, you know, any president can be. What did you think about that and about his, you know, his fumbling about an incursion? It depends if it's a small incursion, a medium incursion.
Yeah, Joyce, I'm not going to sit here and say that I don't want to hear politicians speak candidly. I agree with Susan that more of that should be happening. But I think this is a great example of the risk it poses when you go maybe a bit too off script. In terms of what we've heard on messaging from this government on the Russia-Ukraine situation, their messaging has been extremely tight. I think the Prime Minister probably went the furthest today in saying more words on this than we'd heard from Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly earlier in the week. But I think on this file particularly, it's high risk. It's sensitive, and it's continuing to unfold. So I would get the feeling that this government will be continuing to keep its messaging very tight on this one, whereas maybe we've seen, at least in the last couple of weeks, the Prime Minister in his COVID updates has kind of gone off script or not been reading from prepared remarks, which I thought was kind of interesting. But on Russia and Ukraine, I imagine they're probably very clearly on message track.
So you have a misplay this week.
I do. So my misplay goes to the continued conservative boycott of the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians. Now, the current boycott, Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole took his MPs off of the committee in the last parliament over what is an ongoing debacle over releasing documents related to the microbiology lab in Winnipeg. I'm not going to get into the merits of whether or not that current situation is fair or adequate. There's been, you know, exchanges of open letters and Twitter threads on that. I'll let the MPs go off on that one. But my broader question is more about the message this sends, not having members of the official opposition on this, cross-party committee. Sure, it's not perfect. It's not actually a committee of parliament, but it is the equivalent Canada has to some of our Five Eyes allies' national security bodies. And I just wonder, at a time like this, right now, both what message that sends to our allies about the confidence within Canada of this national security body, but also what benefit it will have, you know, long-term for the Conservatives. I imagine going forward, this committee is going to be looking at a couple of hot files, including potentially China and what has been reported to be attempted interference with MPs during the election, including conservatives. And without conservative MPs on that committee, they're not going to be in the room to figure out what's going on or hear that inside, you know, top secret information. So I'm curious to watch how this one plays out and what happens down the line should the conservatives form government, what they do with this committee, given their current feelings that it's not adequate.
So, Susan, I want to know what you think about this.
Well, you know, just before Christmas, the former ambassador to China, David Mulroney, wrote an interesting piece and was suggesting that what you see the conservatives doing right now on China is a reflection of the fact that they lost this community during the election. The Chinese-Canadian community has stuck pretty closely with the conservatives from the time they were in power, but they lost them in the last election. And I think I am curious to know, like Rachel, I think Rachel makes some great points there, too, about, you know, cutting off their nose to spite their face. But I think the other issue is how much of this is a domestic problem, a domestic internal political issue manifesting itself as an international one.
I wish we had more time. Rachel, Susan, have a great weekend. Thanks again for being there. See you next week. And that's your Power Play Day in Politics. Thank you for being here with us. We'll be back right here on Monday, as usual. Have a safe and happy weekend.